leaving Texas, 4th day of July. Sun so hot, the clouds so low, the eagles fill the sky. Hats to Detroit, lighter than Alice, Santa Fe. The great northern, out of Cheyenne, from sea to shining sea. First train we can ride. We gotta settle one old score, one small point of pride. There ain't a place a man can hide, Shannon, we'll keep him from the sun. Ain't a bed can give us rest now, you keep us on the run.
Hi everybody, this is Brett. Today is Friday, May 29th. And if you're new around here, every Friday, I like to do a free bonus for the podcast audience. We have an expansive bonus content section at schoolsucksproject.com that includes regular monthly productions like In Pursuit of Utopia, a historical series that I previewed for you last Friday, and one of my favorite things to do, one of my favorite productions I've ever had the privilege of being involved with, Picture of the Month Club. And I'm going to give you the first 45 minutes of a two-hour show in this audio. Our most recent film is the Coen Brothers 2007. Ooh, genre. That's a tough one. Because, you know, you say the genre of the film. What genre is No Country for Old Men? It's tricky. It starts out, you're pretty sure you're watching a Western, but then you start to get messed with. Previous installments of Picture of the Month Club include Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, Martin Scorsese's The King of Comedy, Mad Max Fury Road, American Psycho, Terminator 2, and Boogie Nights. So I put this up yesterday, maybe Wednesday, in the School Sucks group, and one of the comments was from my friend and fellow podcaster, Nick Picone. You might remember Nick from episode 600 of School Sucks. He was the host of Music and Liberty. He's kind of rebranded that show. It is now called Peace Freaks, F-R-E-Q-S. And he also hosts another show called Free Markets, Green Earth. But he leaves a comment. My instinct is that I'm going to be bored to tears through this, but I'm giving you both the benefit of the doubt. So I checked back in with him and I said, Nick, how did that No Country for Old Men show work out for you? He said, far more interesting than the movie. And that's quite a compliment, even though he didn't mean for it to be, because I found this movie utterly captivating. I just watched it for the first time right before we recorded. And of course, if you decide you want the whole audio or all the other episodes of Picture in the Month Club or any of the bonus productions we have done, you can go to patreon.com/schoolsucks, patreon.com/schoolsucks. Sign up to contribute $1 per content item. It really helps the show, and it gets you access to, oh gosh, some of the best stuff I've ever done. I want more people to experience these pleasures, and all I ask in return for the experiencing of such pleasures is you help us keep the show going and growing by contributing on a monthly basis. So, man, my co-host Dutch is really on fire in this one. I had only seen it once. I should have watched it 3 or 4 times before doing this, but his insights really just blew me away, and he carried the show, I thought, really nicely. And I hope all of you will listen to this, and when it cuts off at 45 minutes, you'll go to Patreon, sign up to support us, and jump 45 minutes into the full show and just continue listening until the magnificent ending. It took an especially long time to pick music for this one. That's it, and the helicopters are here now, so I better get going.
Okay, corral's just yonder.
Oh, hell's bells. They even shot the dog.
Well, this is just a deal gone wrong, isn't it?
Yeah. Appears to have been a glitch or two.
What calibers you got there, Sheriff?
9mm. A couple 45 ACPs. Somebody unloaded on that thing with a shotgun.
How come you reckon the coyotes ain't been at them?
I don't know. Supposedly a coyote won't eat a Mexican.
These boys appear to be managerial. I think we're looking at more than one fracas. Execution here, Wild West over there.
It's that Mexican brown dope.
Oh, these boys is all swole up. So this was earlier, getting set to trade. Then, whoa, difference isn't. You know, might not even have been no money.
That's possible.
But you don't believe it.
No. Probably I don't.
Well, it's a mess, ain't it, Sheriff?
If it ain't, it'll do till the mess gets here.
Let me ask you something. What's the most you ever lost in a coin toss?
Look, I need to know what I stand to win.
Everything. Just call it Friendo.
Willen, what's in the satchel?
It's full of money.
He's just a guy who happened to find that money.
I got a bad feeling, Llewellyn.
Well, it's a mess, ain't it, Sheriff?
If it ain't, it'll do till the mess gets here.
I'm looking for Llewellyn Moss.
You go up to his trailer?
Yes.
Do you want to leave a message?
Yes.
If I don't come back, you tell Mother I love her.
Your mother's dead.
Well, then I'll tell her myself. Got a loose cannon here.
You think this boy Moss has got any notion of the sorts dead are hunting him?
I don't know, he ought to. He's seen the same things I've seen, and it certainly made an impression on me.
Just how dangerous is he?
Compared to what? The bubonic plague?
The crime you see now, it's hard to even take its measure.
It's just all out war.
You can't stop what's coming.
Is this guy supposed to be the ultimate badass?
You don't understand.
Another month, another picture here.
Another month, another picture, another gathering of friends.
You know, someday we got to start streaming these live, make this a real club.
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm tempted.
A Q&A, an occasional Q&A about the films.
you know, I'm sure there would be plenty of people that would hop on there and be like, you're wrong about your interpretation of this. The movies, they're documents onto themselves. Like, you can interpret it however you please, which is a lot of what I want to talk about today. Movies usually don't come with a glossary to explain what it meant, and I think that is part of the magic.
I totally agree. Can you think of an example where a director, an auteur, rose up and said, hey, everybody is saying that this means this, and they're all wrong, and they need to stop? I can't think of an example.
It doesn't really happen, or think about it this way, too. It's like, have you ever had a compendium to, like, a film written by the director that was like, here is a supplemental work, like a book or a an essay, being like, these are the keys to understanding the film properly. It doesn't happen. I think if it were, it would lose its magic and its wide appeal and any kind of meaning of a personal connection. If you think about it this way, you could watch a movie and connect with it and totally misunderstand it, quote unquote. Right?
Yeah.
And I think that if you were to completely misinterpret it because there's an objective reading of the movie, you'd just feel stupid about yourself and you wouldn't want to watch it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there isn't,
right.
You wouldn't want to partake in that exercise even to know if you were right or wrong, because then you're just maybe just completely depriving yourself of something that you loved.
You're taking a movie and making it a math class, basically. You're losing all the adventure.
Yeah, and you know, I have some inside tracks on things where, like, even, you know, I'll read. I don't do it anymore. I don't read reviews, but there was a point in time I used to read reviews, and there was a movie that came out the same year as this year, filmed in the same place, and everybody had these kind of very, very specific takes about what the movie was about outside of the story of the movie. It's like, you know, the movie is really about this, like political philosophy and X, Y, and Z, right?
Mm.
I met some people involved in the project and in different capacities, and I've asked them the same question. I said, you know, every review I read said the movie was about this thing. But when I watch the movie, I don't see it. And the answer unanimously every time from every party that I spoke to involved was, well, it's not that, because that isn't what the movie is about. That's someone's interpretation of the movie. And I don't know where people get that, but it's become like the most popular interpretation of the movie. And you realize that, I mean, that helped me realize, like, I think it's empowering of, like, how valid and how real my interpretation of the movie was as compared to, like, a group of a consensus of, like, film critic experts. And I was like, oh, I think these guys are wrong. And then asked people that, like, worked on the movie and were intimate with the movie, like, hey, are these people all wrong? And they were like, yes, absolutely, they're wrong. I can tell you for a fact because I made this movie.
You don't want to say what movie it is?
Nah, I mean, it's not only just one movie. This is, like, you know, films I've worked on where I've read, like, really long and really self-assured reviews,
right,
and analysis of, like, this is what the movie is about. This is one that I wanted to talk about even today with this movie, is this thing I see happening again and again, and it's some really good ones for this movie out there, but I find the concept enraging, and they're really popular, so I don't want to disparage them too much because there is a demand for this, but it's like, you know, No Country for Old Men explained on YouTube, you know, or it's like, I've worked on movies where I have these channels, or not even channels, but these clips on YouTube come up that are like, this is an explanation of the movie, whatever the movie is. And there are films that I have worked on that I have, like, really intimate knowledge about, like, why the director made the movie, what the director was trying to say, like, what the scenes, like, are about, you know?
Yeah.
And I watch these things and I'm like, oh man, this couldn't be more off. And not to say that they're always like that, but it's this weird thing of trying to claim it's not my explanation of No Country for Old Men. It's the explanation for this movie in particular. There's a lot of No Country for Old Men explained, not my explanation of No Country for Old Men.
I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to, you know, I've only ever seen this film once, and I saw it Friday night. And I, in these shows, I like to try and stay away from that. And the furthest that I'll go is if there's a nice Charlie Rose, right? Like for American Psycho, there was a nice Charlie Rose interview with Bret Easton Ellis, the director, and Christian Bale. There was one for this with Javier Bardem, Josh Brolin, and the Coen brothers. So I watched that. But it wasn't super revealing, and there wasn't a lot of that like speculation or examination. It was more just talk about the process. And I like that. And it's a way to just kind of engage like a little bit deeper than watching the film, but not going down all of these rabbit holes about it. And really just like it doing this show, because it's either watching movies for the first time or watching it. It seems like it always works out to be seeing movies that I haven't seen in a long time with new eyes. So to really, really be attentive to the actual film watching process, and also going into No Country for Old Men, which I couldn't believe I had never seen. It's inexcusable, but knowing that it was a Coen Brothers film and knowing that there are certain like trademarks in Coen Brothers stories, and there's a certain worldview and maybe oftentimes a kind of cynicism. So if you know the beats that they like to hit over and over again, it helps with the process of watching this movie. So I would say this is also a conversation about how to watch movies or how to optimize movie watching to like really process it the best you can, even in just one viewing.
Yeah, I guess all of the episodes of this project are things that I've really enjoyed as works in and of themselves. And I thought the Boogie Night show that we did was really a really, really strong one. Then I also, in some sense, I'm like, all right, so tonight's is like a really complicated and very like open film. And there are like, which this is going to sound funny because we'll get into this, but there are like rules to the film that are outlined in the film, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I want to try the best we can tonight to not get into trying to fully explain the movie, but a little bit more of what you're talking about is just like how to watch the movie. There's so many beautiful elements of like repetition and mirroring in this film.
Yeah.
In a visual sense, where it's like, you know, all you have to understand from like a deeper understanding of the movie is that there is a reason why these things are repeated. And the end of that is for you to draw your conclusion from what has been laid out before you. I had this idea in my head and I was just trying to interpret this film, and there's so much to be said. And like, we could really get into this like long unpacking of it. And then I thought to myself, like, oh man, this is going to be like a 4-hour show of going bit by bit. Like, this is what this reinforces, and this is what this reinforces. And I said, you know what? Let's play it loose tonight, Brett.
Yeah, I love that idea.
It was like our Mad Max episode where it was like, this movie's all about the feels.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like this is a good movie to be all about the feels, but in a really, just in a different way, because it's really grim and meditative. It's just like meditation on life and death and like the risk you take by living life. And it's, I gotta say, I've watched it twice now in the past few weeks as something I've been using as a bit of like inspiration and also research for another project. It beats me up pretty darn good when I think about this movie. So maybe instead of beating ourselves up, we'll focus on the filmmaking and the repetition and the language in this movie, which I think is really, really strong, and let people have a good time taking from the film what they will.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is a good film for practicing the close watching of a film. The Coen brothers have, I think, a lot of respect for the viewers. You have to kind of pay careful attention. We don't have to, but it's helpful to pay careful attention to like how characters are developed or how the plot is sort of unfolded. So I watched the movie once through Friday night, first viewing ever, like I said. And then, you know, in preparation for the production of this show, I went to like pull some clips and I watched some scenes again and noticed many things that I did not notice the first time. And I was like, oh, okay. Now, of course, all of the scenes, like I had to rewatch all of the Anton Chigurh scenes, who is the villain in the film, and noticed a lot of things about his portrayal, his decision-making,
his presentation, and there's lots of other examples like that as they relate to both character and plot. And I think that's another one of those Coen brothers trademarks. We want to do the plot the best we can.
Yeah, I think that's worth it. And I think that this is actually, plot-wise, is probably the easiest movie that we've done, maybe outside of Mad Max. But yeah, you want to go for it?
Sure. Yeah, I would say that the movie is superficially a Western. That's not an actual genre. Maybe like neo-Western is kind of a genre where it has all of these features or these reminiscences of what Western movies are, but it kind of puts it in a more modern setting, but it's a Coen brothers movie, so it also quickly breaks the convention and expectation of that. But, you know, you have a kind of cowboy character, a sheriff character, you have bandits, you have a bounty hunter, and the way it all goes down is a crime, or I guess it is technically a crime, a drug deal gone wrong. The Josh Brolin character, whose name is Moss, Llewellyn Moss, he's going to be our protagonist, our anti-hero, I think, in many ways. He stumbles across this scene and deduces that there's got to be money somewhere. There's a bunch of dead bodies. He sees the drugs, and he kind of tracks down a suitcase that has about $2.4 million in it. At the same time, law enforcement, a sheriff named Ed Tom Bell, played by Tommy Lee Jones, is also pursuing this as an investigation. The third essential character is Javier Bardem's Anton Chigurh. And this is where conventions get a little bit broken, because even though he is the villain versus kind of the sheriff and the cowboy, it's very unclear what he's all about. I don't want to get too into it right at the beginning, but it's very unclear what his motives are, what his background is, and it leads to like a lot of head scratching and confusion as the film goes on. But he pursues Llewellyn Moss in an attempt to get this stolen money back. And there are several interested parties, the Mexican drug dealers who were, you know, the original participants in this drug deal. There's some kind of American businessmen who are also involved in this. And I mean, those are the basics of the story. It's a pretty straightforward kind of crime gone wrong and pursuit sort of plot, so it seems. Is there anything you want to add?
Yeah, no, Josh Brolin recovers this money from this massacre, and then he's chased by all the interested parties in it, I think, is just like kind of the breakdown of it, right? He's got this $2 million. So both sides of the transaction, the buyers and the sellers, are trying to get their money back, and they hire hitmen to track down the money. Anton Chigurh is one of these hitmen. And you have Tommy Lee Jones trying to kind of piece that all together, and who finds out that Llewellyn is in trouble through his wife. And he is attempting... He's trying to make sure that Llewellyn doesn't get killed because he's mixed up in this bad thing.
Yeah.
And he's wanting to recover this this thing that everybody wants in the movie, which is a bunch of money.
I think that's basically it. Where do you want to start as far as like exploration goes with that?
Yeah, I think that because you hadn't seen this movie, I think like the best place to start this conversation off, and just because honestly, more than anything, I'm just generally interested. Like, what do you think of the movie, and like, did you enjoy it? Did you find it? Just, I guess you can give me your just general reaction to the movie. I think is valuable for the path that we'll try and go tonight.
Sure. So, I mean, I go into it with a bias of like, okay, it's a Coen brothers movie. I know it was like highly acclaimed. So I go in with the expectation that it's going to be very enjoyable. You know, I know I'm looking for what appears to be, you know, very clear and very real in its setting, and maybe even like a pretty straightforward plot that they're going to pull like some kind of switcheroo or something's going to get screwy. So like I have certain expectations going into it. I found the movie and the film's most captivating character, the villain Anton Chigurh, really confounding. Like just to watch it once, there's a lot that leaves you confused and asking lots of questions. And I think that's a great thing. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it was one of their best films that I've seen. The three main actors gave some of the best performances I've ever seen, if not the best performances. I really liked it for, in many ways, its realness. Again, like another feature of the Coen brothers, it's very clear where the film is happening, and they do a really good job of capturing the setting. But it also has this like unrealness to it that I noticed at the same time. Like the most powerful character in the film, again, the villain Shigur, is completely unreal. It's like, how is this a real person? And I think one of the most powerful moments in the film, this is, I don't really think this is any kind of a spoiler, is in all the realness and all the like the grit, it's like unapologetically real in many ways, the violence, the settings, the plainness of certain places. But one of the most powerful moments in the film is a character describing a dream. For me,
oh, yeah.
Which again is in the realm of the unreal, the imagined. That was one thing that I noticed just as it ran, is that it seems to be playing with reality in fiction or imagination or a dreamland or something like that. And there's lots of visual cues that help that out too. But I'm sure we're gonna talk about those. So yeah, I was one of like I said, my favorite Coen Brothers movies that I have seen.
Can I actually, that immediately brings to mind a scene like what you're talking about of like this blurring between fiction and reality. There's some parts of it that are explicit, like when Bell is describing his dreams, his two dreams that he has to his wife, right?
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, there's a moment in this movie that sticks out to me that I'm always playing with in a way that I really like it, and I don't know what it means. And I think it should also be stated, it is totally okay and good and not at all a bad thing at all to not like fully grasp and comprehend things. Like there are like mysteries in life and there would be mysteries in film.
Sure. Yeah.
That I do think that the Coen brothers kind of as directors mess with in their movies. And I think that there's a scene in particular that really, and we should just say like there's going to be spoilers all over the place and we spoil everything. So that's it. We're going to spoil everything. There is the moment where Anton Chigurh goes up into the American businessman from the other side of the drug dealer's office and shoots him immediately. Mm-hmm. So Chigurh like uses his little cattle prod thing, knocks out the lock on a door. And now he's in an office building, and then you see him enter an office building, and he shoots a man who had sent another contract killer to kill him and to locate the money, which as a point of principle for Chigurh is insulting. You pick the right tool, meaning that you had picked the right tool, which is me. There was no reason to bring this other person here, and they've jeopardized my mission, and I'm going to kill you for it. Right, is this kind of murder in the movie that's done by Chigurh out of the sheer principle.
Yeah.
And there's an accountant in the office. And he goes, "Who are you?" Chigurh says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I'm no one." And they have this kind of brief exchange about a plot point, which is about this Woody Harrelson's character, Carson, and why he was involved. And then this is the moment of the scene. It's the end of the scene. It's the button of the scene. And there's this long dramatic pause after it. Again, I don't know 100% of why it's in the movie or what it's supposed to mean, what I'm supposed to deduce from it. But I just know that I like it. And it is the first thing that came to mind when you started talking about this. But the accountant says,
"Are you going to shoot me?"
"That depends. Do you see me?"
And then the scene ends.
Right.
And I don't know if it's like a bit of like a red herring or if this is supposed to be something that's supposed to illustrate something in Chigurh's character. The reason I say red herring is the bad guy is this supernatural force in a certain sense. Like, is he a demon? Is he the Grim Reaper? Is he evil personified, right? And it's like, I think that this gets busted at the end of the movie when he gets hit by a car. He gets hit by a car. He's like totally injured, totally mortal, pays a kid for the shirt off of his back so he got a sling.
Yeah.
and then he walks away, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It like, just in breaking the convention of a Western, he is the only character who gets anything like a ride off into the sunset, you know, at the end.
Oh, yeah.
You're right. I mean, as you're watching it, and as you're even like the shape of his head, like everybody has probably seen this very, at this point, iconic haircut that, and this was the first time, yeah, that I think a lot of people had ever seen Javier Bardem, and they were like, look at this fucking guy, right? So then you see him in any other movie, even in the James Bond movie where he looks kind of ridiculous. And it's like, oh yeah, that's I could see how this is a normal human being, but he has this like almost unhuman appearance, and he is, aside from some very brief moments in the film, entirely emotionless. The times that he shows emotion, it's usually just like a half smile. There is one time where, this is a scene we're going to have to talk about, the coin flip with the gas station owner.
Yep.
And this is one of his moves. It's almost like one of the rules that he puts on this world that he inhabits is that there's a fairness to what he does. And he flips a coin and says, call it. He doesn't say, we're going to do a coin toss, call it in the air. He flips the coin, and then once the toss is over, he covers it with his hand and he says, call it. Almost like he already knows what it is. And you know, there's this scene, it's early in the movie where he's still being kind of like, we're still learning about what kind of a character this is. The problem is we're not learning shit, because all of the times where he kills somebody or thinks about killing somebody or does this coin tosses, am I going to kill you or not? We're just getting more confused by who he is and what he wants and what he's very enigmatic. But in that scene, Shigur says to him, you have to call it. It wouldn't be fair if I called it for you. And when the coin is flipped and when his hand goes down, he sighs, almost what appears to be like, I don't, a remorseful or stressed out kind of way, but it's a deep, noticeable sigh. And it's one of the only times it's so noticeable, him showing that emotion, because he's so devoid of it in the rest of the film.
What's the most you ever lost on a coin toss?
Sir?
The most you ever lost on a coin toss?
I don't know. I couldn't say.
Call it.
Call it?
Yes.
For what?
Just call it.
Well, we need to know what we're calling it for here.
You need to call it. I can't call it for you.
Well, it wouldn't be fair. I didn't put nothing up.
Yes, you did. You've been putting it up your whole life. You just didn't know it. You know what date is on this coin?
No.
1958. It's been traveling 22 years to get here. And now it's here.
And it's either heads or tails.
And you have to say, call it.
Well, look, I need to know what I stand to win.
Everything.
How's that?
You stand to win everything, call it.
All right. Heads, then.
Well done.
Every time he's on screen, he puts a massive amount of tension into the scene, because as he's established through his appearances, like in the first and second act of the film, you don't know what he's going to do. He has no backstory. He has no motive. And yeah, you're kind of left looking at it like, what is this guy supposed to be? Because he's not the villain in a Western, you know, like Llewellyn Moss, the Brolin character, has a lot of these sort of, you know, more modern Western anti-hero kind of, he's cavalier. He's methodical. He's calm when he needs to be. He has a lot of those hero. And
he's an amoral character.
Yeah. Yeah.
Meaning like sometimes he's good, sometimes he's bad. You know what I mean? Like, he's morally gray, which is like places him in newer Western, you know, that places him in the spaghetti Western of like the good, the bad, and the ugly, right? It's like Clint Eastwood is like, he's not a white hat wearing good guy.
Yeah.
There's a moral ambiguity to him. It makes him into the archetype of a revisionist Western hero.
Yeah, they give you 2 points to kind of like root for him or like him. The first is like he's just out poaching. He's out shooting deer or something. And he happens across this drug deal gone wrong where it's a bunch of dead bodies and it's only this one alive guy bleeding to death in the backseat of a truck or sorry, a car. And the guy, he says to him, where's the last man standing? Where's the ultimo hombre? He says to this Mexican drug gang guy. And the guy's just saying, agua, agua, just give me water. He goes, I don't have no agua. And he walks away. Now, you know, right there, it's like, I'm not crazy about it. You know, should have brought agua. You should have agua anyway. If you're out poaching in the middle of the desert, like what's the, there's a question. Why doesn't he have water with him? But part of what contributes to this sort of cumulative confusion as the film goes on. So anyway, you get a chance to like him or at least respect him in seeing how calm and methodical he is in that situation as he quickly puts himself like into the shoes of the drug dealers. And it's like, all right, well, if all this is happening and there's drugs, there's money somewhere. And then he tracks while kind of stopping and talking to himself, like putting himself into the shoes of the person who escaped with the money and then finding the money. So you see that there's like this competence to him that is in many ways heroic.
Yeah. And there's an adventurous spirit in him as well, that I think is like the thing you look for in a protagonist that you want to root for, is he's like willing to chase down the last man because he knows there might be money.
Right. Then he gives us another chance to like him a whole bunch more, but it doesn't make any sense. And again, it just contributes to this growing confusion. He wakes up in the middle of the night and he says, okay. And he goes and he feels, now this has got to be like 8-10 hours later, who knows? But it was daytime and now it's at least 5 or 6 hours later. The guy
is sleeping.
Yeah. The guy who needed agua is dead. But he goes and he fills up a plastic gallon bottle of water. And he goes back to the scene.
Yeah, can I interject for a moment?
Please do, because I'm confused.
This is, I think, the character's moral ambiguity is laid out for you, right? And it's like you contrast him to a character like Bell. Like if Bell stumbled upon this crime scene, his first intuition wouldn't have been to track down the money so that he could keep it, right?
Right, yeah.
He is the white hat wearing good guy, your classic archetypal Western. He represents law and justice. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense of justice. And like you can imagine, if Bell came upon the scene, the way he would have gone about this uncovering that scene would be a whole lot different. Right. But Llewellyn stumbles upon the scene, sees a gun that he likes. So he takes it, finds a man dying who's asking for help. And he says, no agua for you. Right. And he leaves this man here to die. And then he tracks down the last man. And he takes the money and he's taking it for himself, right? He's going to take it home. Him and his wife are going to, you know, go live on an island somewhere. And they're just going to like, that doesn't matter who died, whatever happened.
Right.
Forget about the notion of justice, right? Because there's been this like violent, horribly violent crime, right? Llewellyn doesn't care about justice. The movie isn't about him like finding out like who the good guys and who the bad guys were in that conflict and avenging the good guys or anything like that, or finding the son of a dead drug dealer who doesn't have a father or anything like that, right?
Right.
He goes and he's successful. He gets the money. He hides it and he hides the guns he stole under the porch of his house. He brings the suitcase inside and puts it in his closet. And he's kind of messing around with his wife. And where'd you get that suitcase? At the getting place. But then he goes to bed and he's sleeping. Right. And what you're exactly describing is like he's earning your admiration as he went about his day. He went about this whole thing with his own self-interest at heart. And then he's laying in bed at night and he can't sleep. And he just stops rolling around in his sleep and he looks up at the ceiling and he goes, well, all right.
Yep. That's it.
And so like Llewellyn goes and he fills up the thing of water, jug of water, and wife asks him where he's going. He's, I have something I have to do. All of this only works in retrospect, but it's like this man is demonstrating to us that this man is a man with a conscience and like a heart.
Yeah.
Right. So he's like going to do something really stupid. And he says he's about to do something really stupid. And if I don't come home, tell mama I miss her. And she says, you know, your mom's dead. And he goes, oh, well, I guess I'll tell her myself. He goes back to the scene of the crime just to give this man some water. the amount of like cachet that has in creating a character who at the onset of it, like without this moment, and you're watching this movie, he just takes this money from these guys that are dead. If you don't like his affect, and you don't like his quips with his wife, you think he's just like a low life scavenger kind of.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And this gesture, it's not like he's calling an ambulance for him.
Right.
It's not like he's trying to save his life, right? It's like, this is a thing where like a dying man had like a deathbed request, right? Yeah. Like the water is not going to save that guy.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think Llewellyn thinks the water is going to save that guy. He's not going to him with a blood transfusion bag and a first aid kit.
Right.
He's just going to offer him some water. It's like he is honoring this, I don't know, it's building this like almost like a code of ethics or honor, and also like this kind of cachet for the audience to invest in Llewellyn as a character. And I think it's like incredibly effective. Like I think it's like endearing to him. It makes him an admirable character, even though he might not be a totally like on the narrow. He's definitely not Bell. He's not a sheriff. He's not a deputy. He doesn't stand for justice. He just wants to get into this honeypot of like getting $2 million, and he'll probably kill 3 or 4 more men to just like get away with it. But at the same time, the reason he's not Shigar is that he was gonna accept the request of this dying man to just have some water and relieve his pain before he goes. And I think that like that goes incredibly far in the movie.
It does, because it also, like I said, it's very interactive. It's not like, oh, that's a nice gesture for a dying man. You're watching it and you're going, don't do this. This doesn't make any sense. Obviously that guy is dead now. Why would you go back to such a dangerous place when you already, like, you're just going back to find a dead guy there. There's no other way around that, and you're jeopardizing your own life to do it. So it is the one in the establishing a kind of honor, but at the same time, it's getting you involved with him in a really like curious way, where all the characters do this. Now we got off on Moss by talking about Shigar, but all three of the main characters defy expectations for what they are sort of archetypally, right? Villain, cowboy, or hero, or, you know, antagonist, protagonist, and then like the sheriff, who's sort of like one step behind as the observer and in many ways the narrator. I think the book that the movie's based on is narrated by the sheriff character.
It starts with his voiceover and it ends with his inner monologue about him. And I think that that's something, I don't think it's actually particularly interesting, but like we could probably spend a good 30 minutes arguing about who is the protagonist of the film, because it could very well be Bell.
But the expectations, just like as far as the genre or what you think the genre is are concerned, he's the sheriff, right? He's the sheriff of the county. And he comes across as, he kind of like coats it over in a sort of sarcasm, or, you know, the expected Tommy Lee Jones-ness of the character. But behind that, there's a lot revealed that he's apprehensive. He's fearful. He is always, it seems, almost intentionally. Sometimes he says as much. He's one step behind, right? He's one step behind his underling in the sheriff's department when they're going to go into Moss's trailer after they discover he was part of the scene of the crime, and they go back to his house because his pickup truck is left there. I mean, the other thing too about the, you know, Llewellyn going back, he drives up in his truck. He gets out of his truck, walks down into this like valley to give the guy water, and somebody comes up to basically like, I don't know, like rob his truck or take the tires off it or something, and he has to flee from them. So his truck is then at the scene of the crime, and that's what basically drives the rest of the story forward. So it winds up making sense in the plot. it's necessary to the plot of the film to move forward, but it doesn't make sense when you're watching him get out of bed and fill the jug of water like we already talked about. So with Bell is involved at this point. And they go to his house, Bell and another person from the sheriff's department. He goes, you go in first. I'll hide behind. He says, I'll hide behind you. right? So he is certainly the old man that this is not the country for, right? That's very clear.
100%.
Yeah, in his presentation. What did I say? Apprehensive, fearful, at times confused. And that's part of what he's saying is that, you know, the lawmen in this opening monologue that's like voiceover as the scene is basically set, the lawmen of old, and he says, my daddy was a lawman, my granddad, my uncle, you know, what would they think of this world of today? And then he sort of idealizes this past where lawmen, sheriffs here didn't even used to have to carry guns. And again, like as the audience, you're going, is that true? On the Mexican border in West Texas? Like, isn't that what every country song that ends tragically, doesn't it take place right there? What sheriff did ever have to carry a gun?
Right.
You know, so again, you're confused by his, whatever this is, this confused sounding introduction to the film. But then he is in the plot itself, always kind of like just a step or two behind where he needs to be to see the action. There's examples later in the film that are very impactful, but the first one is tracking Shagur. Shagur, who becomes part of the hunt once the money is missing, and it's still unclear to me like what he was doing there or who he's working for. You say that he's working for these Americans. It just looks like a corporation, like the people who were, you know, buying the drugs.
It looks like a skyscraper in Dallas. Like when Shagur goes out of, you know, he becomes quite upset that Carson, the character played by Woody Harrelson, is brought in as like a, almost like a backup, right? Because the accountant says, you know, he thought that it's the way he says it too is kind of funny. He goes, he felt because the guy's now dead. That having as many people looking for the money at once would be like the best thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Shagur gets really mad and he says, wrong. You choose the right tool for the job.
Which is interesting, right? Because this is what, again, you're like, what the hell is this guy? What the hell is going on here? Who's involved in this thing? In between, I think it's after the shootout when Llewellyn goes back to bring the guy water and the sheriff sort of the Sheriff Bell getting involved. There's this scene where these two guys pick up Shagur and bring him to this scene where this drug deal has gone wrong.
The men hired by the guy he kills that hire Shagur, they're like almost underlings that hired a hitman to track down the money. They give him this device.
Transponder. Yeah.
Transponder. And he turns it on. He turns it off. And then he shoots the guys in the head.
Two less guys, right? I'm the best tool. Okay, yeah, then that makes sense. So let's see. That was a very worthwhile tangent into the three main characters and the ways they defy archetypes. But then that brings us back to Shagur, and you asked some interesting questions like, what is he, right? We talked about his ridiculous hairdo. As the film goes on, he becomes increasingly pale, right? Because he keeps getting injured. He gets shot at one point. He's also like very emotionless, even in dealing with pain or basically doing surgery on himself to remove a bullet in a bathtub, or how he's able to obtain the supplies that he needs by blowing up a car outside of a pharmacy. Like just perfectly calculated, totally emotionless. And there's like lots of interesting things. Like I said, the parts of the film that I rewatched mostly today are the scenes with him, because he seems to be this enigma in the film. And you're right. Like, is he representative of death in like a Grim Reaper kind of way? Is he some kind of idea? Is he imagined by Bell, the sheriff? These are all questions that you ask that obviously we're not going to be able to answer. But you notice things like he's not really there. Like in that line that you brought up, when he goes in and he executes the guy waiting for the money to be returned, the guy who hired him, and he shoots him right in front of another guy, and the guy goes, yeah, I'm nobody, I'm an accountant, are you going to kill me? And he says, that depends, do you see me? He's only ever noticeable to the people that he's directly interacting with, right? Like nobody else ever seems to notice him except for the person who's directly experiencing him,